Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Donald Trump has said his day one in office would include lifting roadblocks to the Keystone Pipeline, which he mentions by name, and in general to production of fossil fuels, including oil, shale, natural gas, and what he calls clean coal. Of course, there's a debate about whether there's any such thing as really clean coal. And he says he'll cancel payments to UN climate change programs on day one to use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. Trump has repeatedly called climate change a hoax, and the Paris Climate Agreement, which just went into effect last week, is now threatened by his election. He says he'll withdraw. Here with me now to help process what Trump's election might mean for the environment in general and the climate change issue in particular is Bill McKibben, the environmentalist, founder of the activist 350.org, which is dedicated to climate change issues, and the author of many books, including Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Hi, Bill. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you as always.
Are you reeling?
You know, don't blame me. I'm from Vermont. I spent a year out campaigning with Mr. Sanders, and we tried to tell people that this was what was coming down the pike. There's a lot of anger out there. And unfortunately, it took the unlikely form of a, you know, chubby, privileged billionaire from someplace in the canyons of Manhattan.
Listeners, your climate change and the Trump administration calls. Questions for Bill McKibben, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let me go down that list a little bit. These are things from the actual document that the Trump campaign released on his first 100 days and see how possible you think they are and, you know, what would actually be involved. So, for example, this is one people probably didn't hear about much until he announced that he would cancel it. The payments to the UN climate change programs to use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. What do we pay the UN for with respect to climate change?
The main thing that we've said is that we'll pay a small sum in the grand scheme of things, I think about $500 million a year to help poor nations leapfrog over the fossil fuel age and onto sun and wind. It's obviously the cheapest place in the world to do this and the most practical, not mentioning that it's also a moral necessity given that we were the ones who filled the atmosphere with carbon and started raising the temperature of the earth.
Is that part of the Paris Climate Agreement?
It is part of the Paris Climate Agreement. The Paris Climate Agreement, as some of us pointed out at the time, was an agreement without any enforcement mechanism at all. And that means that though Donald Trump can't literally pull the U.S. out of it on day one, it'll take, I think, 3 years legally to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accords. He can simply not spend any money doing anything about it. Our meeting our targets under the Paris Climate Accord predicated on following the Obama Clean Power Plan, and he's clearly not going to be doing that, not going to be doing a lot of other things. We won't come close to meeting our targets. So in real terms, he's withdrawing us from the Paris Accords.
He doesn't have an EPA administrator yet. It's too early for that. But I read that Trump does have a choice already to lead the EPA transition team, and that is Myron Ebell, a well-known and proud climate change skeptic. Are you familiar with Myron Ebell?
Yes, he's been at this work for a very long time, and he's been leading for months now the Trump energy climate transition team. So he'll doubtless have a all-star list of the remaining climate deniers, most of whom come from, in one way or another, the fossil fuel industry.
And it appears Trump will gut President Obama's domestic emissions regulations, which the president put into place largely because he knew he couldn't get any actual legislation through a gridlock Congress. This has been in the courts, as you know, and Trump considers it unconstitutional.
He'll be doing more than that. I think that there'll be there's a long Republican wish list, and it includes things like selling off the country's public lands, its national forests, to private industry. If you want to go drill an oil well in a national park someplace, now would be a good time to take out your application.
But on day one, because it was an executive action by President Obama, can Trump just flick his finger and, you know, sign a pen and undo the power plant emission rules?
That I don't know. I don't know how much of it is now encoded in statute, but he can do a lot. And if everyone knows that it won't be enforced, that there'll be nobody pushing them on it, it probably amounts to much the same thing.
Put on your headphones. We're going to take some phone calls. Leading climate change environmentalist Bill McKibben with us here in the studio at WNYC. Our lines are full. People really want to talk to you. And one of them is Alan in Manhattan. Alan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks very much for the chance to speak to you. On issues of trade and infrastructure, do you think there's a possibility Trump will have ways of achieving things indirectly that are favorable to climate change efforts without putting that label on it? In other words, one of the ways of combating climate change is to finally put a price on the carbon cost of shipping freight across 10,000 miles to and from China. Currently, that carbon cost is exempt even under the Paris Accords. And also on infrastructure, without focusing the attention on the fact that much of the infrastructure he could be in favor of would be solar and wind infrastructure in addition to traditional water, sewer, and road.
Yeah, interesting. Do you think there's a point on that last thing that Alan said? Do you think there's a potential point of negotiation, or whatever the right word is, with Trump, since he says he wants a big infrastructure program, which, you know, that at least sounds more like a traditional Democratic agenda item. Could some of that be renewable energy infrastructure?
Well, it could. My guess is that people like Myron Ebell are making sure that it won't. But that said, among the very few things we know about Donald Trump, and we really don't know much because, you know, his mind is kind of a black box.
And he didn't run a very policy-oriented campaign.
But one of the things we know about him is that he likes building big things, okay? That seems to be a clear part of his – consistent part of his character. The biggest thing, the biggest job, the only truly big job that the U.S. economy could conceivably have in front of it is the transition off fossil fuels and onto renewable energy. I wrote a piece this summer really with kind of this scenario in mind, saying the amount of jobs and economic activity you could produce across the upper Midwest, which is where Trump won his victory, by emulating what we did in the early days of World War II, except this time not with bombers and tanks but with solar panels and wind turbines, the numbers are astonishing. Were he serious about any of this, that's what he'd do. I have a feeling he's probably not that serious about any of it.
Another thing on his list is, well, Keystone. What's the status of Keystone?
Well, Keystone at the moment is dead, but it will likely spring back to life. It'll take them a while to decide if they want to build it again. The investors, they may have a little bit of trouble finding eager investors, but out of pure spite, they may decide to build it. The more pressing pipeline fight at the moment, the one that'll come first in line, is what's going on in the Dakotas right now. Where the Sioux Nation and 200 other Indian tribes are at a remarkable encampment at the confluence of the Missouri and Cannonball Rivers, trying to block a pipeline under that river. At the moment, we'd settle for the Obama administration doing the right thing in its last 70 days in office, and there'll be big rallies and across the country in more than 100 cities on November 15th to ask the Army Corps of Engineers for once not to screw Indian nations. But even if we win it in the Obama you know, in the Obama epilogue.
Yeah.
Whether or not it'll last is an open question. But these are the things around which one has to organize so that people at least understand what's at stake. Even most people in Trump's America feel shame for what we've done to Native Americans over the last 400 years. Anyone who doesn't has no moral character at all. And so this is a very important place to be fighting.
And that happens to intersect at Standing Rock with fossil fuel infrastructure.
Exactly right.
Susan in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hello. My question is, what the hell do we do now?
You could be every caller on every segment right now.
Well, look, I don't have by any means all the answers, and I'm as stunned in certain ways as anybody else. Though, as I say, having spent a year with Bernie, I had a sense of some of what was out there. I think that actually Bernie plays a big role in the weeks ahead. He's the most popular politician in America. It's very clear that the Democratic Party, if it's going to exist in a meaningful way in the future, has to be completely restructured. The idea of the D.C. establishment elite doesn't work for anybody.
What do you mean by he's the most popular? Because he would not to replay the primary, but
if you look at his polling numbers, his favorability numbers, he's 10 points ahead even of Barack Obama.
Huh.
Okay. He's the one politician in America that everyone really trusts, mostly because he's the one guy who's been saying the same thing over and over again for 30 years. Believe me, if you live in Vermont, you've heard it many, many times.
So what can he do?
Well, I think that I think job one is figuring out how to restructure the Democratic Party so that it's actually a party of the people, not of the kind of Hillary Clinton inside elite D.C. thing that, as it turns out, people just really hate. And I think the second thing is he and Elizabeth Warren and a few others are going to have to be a kind of visible moral power center in the Senate. They're not going to be able to stop things from happening most of the time, but they're going to have to make the strong, loud, profound case. Remember, Trump has great legal powers now and can do an enormous number of things. What he can't do, one of the ways we fight him is to change the zeitgeist in this country. And if we do, if people begin to wake up what's going on, if people begin to be upset by it, then it's not that his legal authority diminishes, but some of his room for maneuver begins to diminish. And so that case is going to have to be made hard and regularly. And I was pleased to see the statement that Bernie issued yesterday. We said, we'll work with Mr. Trump as long as he's willing to do the things he was talking about, help working people, whatever. But the minute that his racism, his sexism, his anti-environmentalism impinges on that, we're going to stand and fight.
Raya in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. He actually answered my question very well. I feel like I don't know what to do. I don't know how we can act. 7 in 10 Americans believe climate change is real. So if Trump, he loves to be loved, he loves the adoration of people. So how can we convince him that if he helps us on climate change, then that's the good thing to do? That's how the people will be behind him. A lot of his supporters must believe climate change is real. If 7 in 10 Americans believe it's real, what can we do? How can we show him that it's serious?
The only way to demonstrate to politicians that you care about something is to be active on it. And, that's begun to happen. It took – we were able to get nothing out of President Obama in his first administration on climate change. Then people took to the streets. 400,000 people marched memorably through the streets of New York, the biggest demonstration New York has seen in decades. And that began to turn President Obama around. He became an effective climate president, or at least more effective in his second term. Trump will be harder, but I do think that the caller, that Raya, makes a very good point. One of the other things we know about this guy is he's vain. And, a constant appeal to his vanity to be the protector of people and of the country against what is clearly its biggest threat. And remember, one of the things about climate change is we have – it's not a static argument. Mother Nature will continue to provide an endless series of teachable moments. Some of those teachable moments will be very profound. The place where the Bush administration finally lost its mojo was with Hurricane Katrina and the inept response to that. One imagines that there'll be similar episodes sooner rather than later.
Do you think there's anything to work with? And Raya, thank you for your call. Call us again. Anything to work with in, for example, this statement from the First 100 Days Agenda that says cancellation of payments to UN climate change programs to use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. So a suggestion, at least, even though it's from this nationalist America First context of, well, I don't want to give money to other countries to develop their infrastructure, I want to use that money at home. He does say use the money to fix America's water and environmental infrastructure. And he has been said to care about clean water as an environmental issue.
Flint,
as a starting point for something?
It could be. Flint seems to be the only issue on which every person running for president agreed, because how could you not? It's actually not okay to have poison water flowing through the faucets of Americans. We spent 100 years building the fantastic water supply system so that we wouldn't need Trump brand bottled water for people. So, that would be a perfectly good thing to be spending some time and attention on, and he'll get no argument from anyone if he spends some serious money rebuilding our water infrastructure. Among other things, it would provide jobs to precisely the people that we really can't afford to have building oil pipelines.
Justin in East New York. You're on WNYC with environmentalist Bill McKibben. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Brian. Love your show. Mr. McKibben, great respect for your work. My question is regarding whether we can take a silver lining out of Hillary Clinton's defeat in that it may push the Democratic Party to make its next nominee someone who does not engage in the policy position of fracking as a transitional fuel, and push them towards a nominee who backs the keep it in the ground rhetoric. And to that end, are you familiar with Kanye West's position on fracking, Kanye 2020? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much.
I haven't had a chance to sit down with Kanye and discuss fracking yet. The caller makes a good point. You know, Bernie named me.
A text, by the way, from a college student who said something to the effect of, let's see how much we can prevent Trump from ruining the country until Kanye 2020 is the next president. So this is going around.
Okay, good. Good to know. I got Bernie named me as one of his five people to get to write the platform of the 15. So I, for the first time, got to see what the Democratic Party sort of looked like a little bit from the inside. And the caller picks just the right issues. These were the places we couldn't get the Clintons to budge.
Mm-hmm.
Was around fracking and keep it in the ground stuff. On other things, we were able to persuade them to make at least some changes. But these are things that the Democratic core and base deeply cares about. And there are a lot of people willing to go to work on this stuff. We saw what happened in New York, across upstate New York, you know, across as red a New York as there is, when fracking was the issue.
Cuomo entirely banned fracking in New York State. Clinton's position was not that. Bernie said, ban it nationally. She said she wanted to look at a case-by-case basis scenario.
Yep.
And that there would probably be few cases, but fracking would seem, you know, both energy productive and environmentally safe.
She wanted to hedge, which was turned out to be the problem.
Do you think, though, that if Trump is generally pro-fracking, that an incremental approach might be useful at this point? I'm not talking about as a candidate to run against them someday.
You may know better than me.
I'm just asking in terms of pointing out particular situations.
Sure.
Look, you can't do it here. You can't do it
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
And then it establishes some baselines.
One of the jobs of the environmental movement over the next little while, because remember, for a while, Trump's going to be riding high and completely powerful and popular and stuff. One of our jobs is just merely going to be paying careful attention and bearing witness to those dumb things that get done in order to build precisely the kind of narrative that we need to change things around. And, you know, the caller said maybe there's a silver lining there. There really isn't a silver lining in that this is going to be an intensely bad 4 years. It comes at the worst time for the climate change stuff, just when we were beginning to get a little bit of head of steam on clean energy, and now we've hit not a pothole but a ditch, you know. But the silver lining, if there is one, is it should get people to understand that we need real action, not rhetorical action. Rhetorical action didn't win the election.
Climate change did not come up in any of the presidential debates. There were exactly zero questions on the environment at all. Are you shocked by that?
If I told you I was shocked, I'd be lying, because it's been hard work to get anyone to pay attention. The only good news is that Mother Nature will continue to hit us upside the head until we do.
Talk for just a minute before you go about one of the heroes of the environmental movement, Jonathan Schell. Bill will be speaking tonight, you Bill McKibben fans, but I gather it's sold out, but we'll just announce that this is going on at the Tishman Auditorium at the New School at 7 o'clock on the fate of the Earth. And some of you know that was the title of the iconic book by Jonathan Schell.
So Jonathan was a great hero. This is the first what will be an annual series of lectures. He died last year. When I first arrived at The New Yorker as a young man, Jonathan had just published The Fate of the Earth. It was the book that freed me up 7 or 8 years later to write the similarly portentously titled The End of Nature, which was the first book about climate change. His was about nuclear war. These are the two places where we understand that humans have grown so large that they can affect everything on the planet, and it means that we have to be ready to resist, and we are.
Bill McKibben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and all those I voted stickers on Susan B. Anthony's gravestone, the pantsuits worn to polling places. It was slow coming, but Election Day brought out the enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton and her potential for making history. From, it turns out, some women, Clinton got the votes of large majorities of Black and Latino women, and white college-educated women voted for her for the most part, but Trump won the majority of white women's votes overall. One of the themes that we're hearing over and over since the election is, what do we tell our daughters? And this is what Hillary Clinton herself said in her concession speech yesterday. Oh, you don't have the clip. Okay, thought we'd have the clip. So let's talk about it with Alexis Grinnell, co-founder of Pythia Public, a political and public affairs firm and frequent contributor to the Daily News, and Michelle Goldberg, Slate columnist and author of The Goddess Pose. Welcome back, Michelle and Alexis.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Brian.
What do you make of the results? I just gave some of those results. 58%, a majority of white women voted for Trump, according to the exit polls. In fact, by 10 points, 53% to 43%. Do we have to start there?
Well, I think it's very clear that for 53% of white women, patriarchy works, and they prefer it over equality. And why that is a really interesting question, and we can unpack it on several levels. But if Trump wants all Muslims to take responsibility for terrorists, I guess as a white woman, I'd have to take some responsibility for all the 53% of white women who made the wrong choice. So
and
I'm sorry.
I also think that, you know, women have never really voted. I mean, women as a majority always vote Democratic, but women across the board don't vote as a block. They see themselves, you know, and to some degree rightly, as part of other identities. And so there's a lot of white women who see themselves as white and Christian before they see themselves as identifying with other women. And also, we know there's a lot of social science research to suggest that powerful women, you know, they provoke more anxiety in men, but they provoke anxiety in women as well, right? Basically every society known to man, one of the central divisions in the society is one of gender roles. And when that starts to break down and shift, it causes, you know, tremendous upheaval, tremendous panic. It's a really radical thing. It's one of the reasons why I was so hopeful on Tuesday. I mean, I really thought for a minute that, like, my daughter's life was not going to be a lesser life than my son's. And today I don't feel like that.
I think it's a really good point, though, to make that women are also people who reinforce gender roles. And that is something that we see.
Not just men.
Not just men. And women, certainly in this case, who are choosing and preferring a system that advantages them in certain ways and certainly denies them equality in others, are systematically ignoring people in their gender group who would benefit from a different system, and in so doing reinforcing a universe that privileges their life.
You know, I was walking around Trump Tower in the afternoon. There was, you know, supporters and protesters, and I saw there was selling stickers, or not stickers, they were selling buttons, you know, the ones you've seen before, adorable deplorables and hot chicks vote Republican. And I think that there are a lot of women, you know, especially who see rightly what our society values in women, and and kind of understand what is going to be valued in them and kind of what it's advantageous, you know, and I think this is all on a subconscious level, what it's advantageous for them to identify with. Do they want to identify with the woman who's not like those other bitchy, shrill women? Or do they want to identify with the woman who has been smeared and demeaned as unsexy, unfeminine, a ball breaker, you know, shrill, unfashion. I mean, just every kind of demeaning stereotype about women in general has been attached to Hillary Clinton. And I understand why it's very fraught, I think, for a lot of people to see themselves in her.
I think part of what we're mourning is certainly the possibility of the realigning of those narratives. So what I would have seen in a Clinton presidency is the complete transformation of leadership, the idea that caregiving and parenthood is not incompatible with strength, the idea that being female is fundamentally not othered, and that there is a value to a person's ideas and power regardless of their gender if, in fact, they merit it. And the idea that we had – and again, this is your – I'm speaking from a place of grief that I think so many of us are in, and this processing is going to be a long time coming. But the idea that she was so insanely qualified and she lost to, I mean, we rejected.
And she lost to the most unqualified man.
I feel like we treated her like our mother. We undervalued her. We yelled at her. We blamed her for things she was not responsible for. And then we elected the beast we keep chained up in the basement. It's bizarre and just disconcerting beyond words.
Why do you think some of the deconstruction that you're doing right now wasn't more a part of the mainstream debate during the election campaign? From you guys it was. But I don't know. It seemed to me that it was buried in a way that it didn't have to be buried in a lot of the media. And it was more about, you know, Hillary is part of the establishment and things like that, without this as an additional narrative.
I mean, it's hard for me to say. I mean, to me, it seemed very present. And, you know, I actually think that it was probably very present for a lot of Trump voters. You know, I think that there was some research that was I think it came out of the University of Michigan, and they published some of their results in the Washington Post that said, you know, sexism was more correlated with Trump's sexism was correlated with Trump support over and above every other kind of variable. Yeah. And, you know, I think that you're seeing a lot of, you know, I've had friends, like, just this is in my own little bubble of liberal New York. I've had friends in the last couple of days being jeered by men on the street, being like, "You're crying, Hillary supporter." I had a friend who was 7 months pregnant that somebody started being like, "Oh, you're a Hillary supporter. I bet you're sad now." Right? I think that there is so –
You're a woman.
Knowing that she was a sad-looking older woman. And, you know, I wrote a piece yesterday, you know, which started with a quote by Germaine Greer that said, you know, Germaine Greer once said, women have really no idea how much men hate them. And, you know, now we do. And I think that the sense of Hillary Clinton has been a kind of metonym for unseemly female ambition for her entire 25 years in public life. I came across this old 1996 Weekly Standard essay, a 4,000-word piece called The Feminization of America that was, you know, decrying the coming matriarchy. And it both begins and ends with Hillary Clinton, who then has no political power whatsoever. Mm. And the last line is, "Hillary Clinton is welcoming men to their new role as the second sex. And so I think that this narrative of kind of gender and power was very present in the election. And I just think that that is a big part of what those men who streamed to the polls were rejecting.
Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Michelle Goldberg and Alexis Grinnell. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to say that, so I'm a white woman, I'm educated, and I realized too late that I did not have enough enthusiasm for Clinton for a long time, even though I've been a supporter for a long time. And I think that I, and maybe many people, were influenced by the far left, never Clinton movement. And I realized too late that in my life, all the people I knew in that area were men. And I think that they voted for Obama twice and failed to realize that Clinton's domestic policies are very similar to Obama's policies and did not acknowledge the implicit bias that may have been at play in making their decision. And I think on the far left, we tend to think that we're immune to these kind of biases, and it's not okay. I think it may have affected this election.
Jennifer, thank you. Elizabeth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi. Yes. So I called in because, as hard as it is, I voted for Trump. I'm college educated. I graduated from Tufts. I'm a feminist. I'm an artist. All my work is about feminine values. I wake up every day and struggle with the weight of dealing with living in a patriarchy, and I wish every day I could wake up and change that so that we could all engage in this world freely and equally without being hindered. But
and with
I
that
had
grounding,
this, like,
you voted for Trump?
I know, and that's why I'm calling to say this, because the rhetoric regarding women who voted for Trump is very generalized and I think makes very overreaching comments. I, since I was very young, have not liked Hillary Clinton. I think that if women really could run, if any little girl's able to become president, then why would the first lady of a former president be our only option for the first female president.
Michelle, you both obviously want to talk to Elizabeth. Michelle, you want to go first?
I mean, I think that you have decided there are two things that you can either vote for Trump because he's sexist, or you can vote for Trump in spite of his sexism. But either way, you've done something deplorable. And that's true, I think, even if you are an educated New York liberal artist.
I would ask a question. You mentioned that since you said something like, since I was a little girl, I've never liked Hillary. Do you like Donald Trump?
I do not like Donald Trump, but I don't think that we've discussed enough the amount of the things that Hillary has done that have not been pro-woman.
I think that this question of likability is really central, because we know from all the data and the research that women are held to this nebulous standard of likability that we do not hold men to. What it means and what it really signifies is sort of this not maleness or not something else-ness, not on script for a woman. And to litigate how she has not appropriately lived up to the sort of ideal or even feminist ideal that you may have, I think, is so far removed from what's relevant to the best interests of women writ large and certainly this country. And that's a conversation I think is worth having in living rooms and with your friends and even in public radio. But I cannot condone it as a way in which to choose a president.
And I also, I'm curious, I would like to know what it is that she thinks that policy-wise Donald Trump would improve upon Hillary Clinton.
We're going to end on this because our time's going to disappear. But Manhattan, Elizabeth, can you answer that in like 10 seconds?
In 10 seconds.
Policies that he's going to implement that will improve the lot of women?
God. Again, this is just a very hard topic to discuss, but it comes down to, across the board, I think Trump will do less damage than Hillary.
And I have to leave it there, except for a last word from Alexis, because I think you're bursting at the moment.
You've seen me gesticulating wildly.
Or what comes next? Forget about the caller.
What comes next? This is really makes all the work that we do more urgent. If anything, I am getting over my grief, getting to the fight, feeling the power. And I think what we say, what we do, what we write, and how we organize in the next 4 years is going to be critical.
I mean, I think that the most important thing that we can do right now is not let ourselves, not let this become normalized, not let ourselves keep in, hold on to every day that this is fascism and this is not okay.
To be continued. Michelle Goldberg from Slate, Alexis Grinnell, Daily News contributor, among other things. Thank you both.
Thanks, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Happy Election Day, everybody. Thank you for spending a little of it with us. One of these is the real Donald Trump. Is it this one?
We're going to get them out. We're going to secure the border. And once the border is secured, at a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
Or is it this one?
She wants open borders, and that is crazy. I mean, people are just pouring into this country from Mexico, and a lot of them are very bad hombres.
Okay, listeners, which one was Donald Trump and which one was Alec Baldwin? That's how creepy good Alec's portrayal was this fall on Saturday Night Live. One of them, either Donald Trump or Alec Baldwin, joins me now. Welcome, sir, and happy Election Day.
Well, thank you for having me, Brian. I'm trying to shed the Donald Trump cloak.
Your Trump was so real. It was creepy. Was it creepy to play him, or can you detach yourself as an actor from that?
I think normally, I mean, I'm not an impressionist per se, but if you do any kind of comedy and they ask you to do that, most of the time there's some degree of appreciation, I think, involved. It's somebody you like. If you do De Niro or Pacino or Tony Bennett or any of the stuff I've done in these routines I've done. And Trump is somebody who, you know, I don't hate Trump, but he's not somebody I admire. So it was more difficult.
I was going to ask you kind of exactly that question, that you're an actor, not an impressionist. So how did you develop the Trump character?
You just watch him, and you watch him, and you try to see. And again, what you do is a caricature, like a caricaturist who draws. If you look at Patrick Oliphant or someone, and people who would draw,
cartoonists,
Barry Blitt, mm-hmm. Steve Brodner, they exaggerate, and this is an exaggeration of his masticating every word, and I almost sprained my jaw pushing my lower jaw, you know, forward to talk the way he does and say Putin. And then, you know, his enunciations and things like that. So it's, I mean, do I sound like him? Kind of. But I think what you get is an essence of him being very feral.
Yeah. Did you rehearse in front of a mirror to get
yes.
that fish mouth just right?
Yes, yes. I would sit in a room while they were doing my makeup, and I would say, I won't say the line that I used on your show, but you can imagine what line. I would sit there and probably 30 or 40 times in a row, I would say, grab them by the blank. Grab, you know, try to get his enunciation.
You could say it on cable or Howard Stern. How did the casting come about? Did you call up Lorne Michaels and say, I have a concept, or did they call you?
No, they called me. Lorne, I think, was they knew where they were headed with election coverage and it being as close as it was. I think a lot of people, you know, months ago were surprised by that. And apparently Tina Fey was the one who is always in Lorne's universe and talking to him about material and sketches, and her idea was for me to play him.
Is she, even years after being on the show?
Yeah, we finished the show 4 years ago this December. And when he asked me, I said no. I don't want to do that. I don't think I can do that. I mean, he had Taron Killam, and he had a Daryl Hammond. He had a couple people who were in his compound there who could do it, I thought, better than me. And I thought, I don't want to do it. I don't think I can, you know.
But
well, I mean, you get lucky, you know. You just find, and I also think people were ready to take in that version of him, which is so aggressive. You know, the writing, I find a key to kind of play in, but none of it works if the writing's not there. And of course, he's the head writer of his own comedy routine. Everything he just supplied to us.
Oh, really? Is the creative process that everything is supplied to you, or do you as the actor contribute to writing sketch comedy at Saturday Night Live?
I mean, you make slight suggestions or words that you think maybe that's even Trump, believe it or not, they would sometimes write a line which completely lacked self-awareness. And I said even Trump is more self-aware than that. Mm. But what I'm saying is that Trump himself is the head writer. when we sit down and we think about what to say, and when the writers write down what to say, Trump is supplying them all the material that they need.
The New York Times TV critic James Poniewozik wrote yesterday that SNL faced near impossible expectations, first to wring laughs out of a national nervous breakdown, and second to improve on a political reality so self-spoofing that it writes its own male P-part jokes. Did you see it that way?
I think the way that I saw it first, you know, originally was that there's Trump, the star of this reality show for many seasons. I mean, the interesting thing is the world I live in, or the world you live in, and many of my friends who live in New York and Los Angeles and so forth in the business, they don't watch The Apprentice. And The Apprentice was a huge success, and Trump was a huge television star who managed to trick people into thinking that he was that guy from that show, this can-do executive and so forth. And in the rest of the world, especially in New York, Trump is not admired in New York the way he is in the rest of the country. And that's a huge feat that he achieved. In New York, Trump, I mean, I'm not going to denigrate him and say he's a punchline or he's a joke or what have you, because he has had tremendous success in some areas. But he's someone in New York who is, to a degree, just endured, you know. And he's very garish and so forth, and very self-serving and self-seeking. So that, to me, is the miracle of this candidacy, is that this guy was able to fake everybody out into believing that he really is the guy in The Apprentice.
Yeah, but we hit a point with Trump, and Alec Baldwin is my guest, if you're just joining us, after having played Trump on Saturday Night Live this fall, where you didn't have to have all new written material to satirize him. You could just use his own real words as some of your lines, as when we played you and him saying bad hombres. Was that a conscious decision you and the SNL producers made?
I think they didn't have any choice, really. They couldn't go any other way. I mean, every week we'd sit there on a Tuesday and they'd have a table read on a Wednesday, and everybody would say, just wait. You know, any moment now, he's going to give us some fresh material.
Yeah, right,
and
really.
He would. I mean, within 12 hours, we had a whole new sketch idea for something he served up.
I was thinking about how Kate McKinnon, who's a real staff member at SNL, had a different job than you in a way. You were a visitor. You were a tourist. But she was working on being the actor who will now probably play the president of the United States for the next 4 years if she wants to on Saturday Night Live.
If she wins, yeah, if she wins.
Do you think that was a different acting challenge because she had to anticipate continuing?
Well, I think that Kate is – first of all, I'm very grateful that not only that, you know, they asked me to do that and people were in the mood to accept that, because under different circumstances, things could be adjusted ever so slightly and it wouldn't have worked. I mean, it worked because people were ready to send up that Trump, this kind of feral guy. But Kate – one of my greatest joys is I got to do it with Kate, because Kate is so talented. I mean, she's just this staggeringly talented woman. And she's smart because she mixes the sweet and the sour in there. I mean, there's Hillary, the very, very driven and very, very ambitious woman. And then there's Hillary, who's really kind of this – she's made her into this really sweet, almost kind of cartoon character and lovable in a way. And that's Kate's gift. She mixes both.
She did walk that line.
She walks that line beautifully.
From a sketch actor standpoint, maybe you don't want to go here at all, which is fine, but would you compare Amy Poehler's Clinton to Kate McKinnon's in any way?
I think Amy is sharper. You know, she's not as maybe there's less sweet and there's more vinegar in Amy's performance, but that's what you expect from Amy. I mean, everybody has a kind of a persona. And Amy is very, very improvisatory. You know, she's right out of UCB, Upright Citizens Brigade, and Groundlings, and has that, which I think Kate is too. But Amy is just much more a little darker. I think Amy's a little darker.
Now, we should mention that you're not just – an actor to me, your colleague, because you have a WNYC show too, your podcast Here's the Thing.
Right.
And I am supposed to mention, and I'm delighted to mention, that there will be a live taping of Here's the Thing,
Alex Smith,
with Patti Smith, Wednesday, December 14th at 8 at the Mayer Performing Arts Center in Morristown, New Jersey. And you can get tickets at WNYC.org/events. Any particular reason for that one before a live audience?
Well, we have the availability of people here in New York. I mean, sometimes I do these things when I'm in Los Angeles on business periodically, or we were in London once. We tried to do it. We did a Super Bowl one in Indianapolis or New Orleans. As you well know, booking people is difficult and stressful, and trying to get them to come into the studio when I'm available. And this is more of a part-time gig for
me. Oh, but I'm jealous of you because you know all these A-listers. And if you want Paul Simon, you get Paul Simon. If you want Patti Smith, you get Patti Smith.
Well, someone gets them for me.
We have to introduce ourselves, explain who we are, why do we want to interview, all that ordinary stuff.
Well, now, let me ask you a question while I have you here, because I'm a great fan of yours. So what do you think was Trump's key to success? What do you think he did to paddle himself up there against that current and beat all these formidable people and become – and now it's so close. Some people are predicting that it's within the margin of error, under 3 points.
Right. Although I will repeat, as I said at the beginning of the show, that Nate Silver is now giving Hillary Clinton a let's see, what's 100 minus 28? Trump a 28% chance of
72.
Winning. Thank you. Which is, you know, scary enough if you don't want Trump to be president, 28%
right.
chance.
Right.
But 302 electoral votes he is projecting for Hillary Clinton. But I think his non-political correctness, his aggressive non-political correctness, or we might call it, you know, hate speech or whatever, felt liberating mm-hmm. to a lot of people in
iconoclastic
Republican yeah. working class, like white feeling disenfranchised America. Mm. I think against,
I still don't get the white feeling disenfranchised America thing. I don't. Disenfranchised from what?
Well, one of the great skits on Saturday Night Live was the Black Jeopardy
yeah.
skit, right? Where Tom Hanks played that white working class, aging, disenfranchised guy, and every question that was asked, you know, from a sort of black disenfranchisement perspective, he had the right answer to because he was living the same life, on, like one down, you know, until they got to the question, all lives matter. What
right.
lives matter?
Right.
So that, you know, they're out there. We know they're out there.
Well, I just hope, as everyone says, that after today we have some unification somehow, because it seems, I mean, for Trump to announce yesterday that if he doesn't win, this was the biggest waste of his time. And I thought it's a shame that he could have won. She was beatable if he had unified with the party, if he had made two or three. You don't have to be a political insider to think of the two or three things he might have done to have vastly improved his chances, and he might even have won. And he might have created a great role for himself in this country among these disenfranchised voters had he said certain things about the aftermath if he loses. But he just keeps getting it wrong every time he opens his mouth. It's tragic, really.
And he just lets his hate get the better of him every single time.
Now, I often wonder if there – I hate saying this, but I often wonder if there's something wrong with him, like medically. Because he just – I mean, it's like this compulsive need to burn every bridge. It's like he's a pyromaniac almost in that sense.
Did you see – this may not be the best example, but he attacked Beyonce and Jay-Z, who performed at a Hillary rally the other day. And he attacked rap music generally in that rant as, are they singing or are they talking? I don't know if they're singing or they're talking. And I'm like, what is this? You know, 1973? And so out of touch at the same time he's asking black voters, what have you got to lose?
I think the other thing about him, and I mean this sincerely, because we've all had who are public figures have had our difficulties and our reversals in the press and so forth. I feel bad for his family. You know, he's got a family, he's got kids, he's got grandchildren. The Trump name is now going to mean something else from here on in. And before that, I can't really say what the Trump name meant. It was about merchandising and so forth, and real estate, empire, what have you. But I think Trump's name means something else now, and I don't think it's what he aimed for.
We've talked about on the show how it's a real challenge for Ivanka Trump, for example, who now when the professional women who she's trying to market her clothing lines to wear a Trump outfit, even an Ivanka Trump outfit, has this other meaning, and so people may not.
There's an article in the Times about that,
yeah.
About that line she's walking.
Alec Baldwin with me on WNYC after having done the Trump character on Saturday Night Live this fall. By the way, about here's the thing. How do you like doing radio interviews?
I love doing it. We get people – I mean, for the most part, I pick the people that come on, and I try to think of people who have the breadth of a career. They've been doing something for many, many years, and they don't have to be somebody who's, you know, old. I mean, or somebody from my generation that was a part of my musical or theatrical or cinematic heritage. I mean, we did Herb Alpert and Lorne and Paul Simon, but then we do Kristen Wiig. We do, you know, people that are younger – We did Lena Dunham. We booked people who we think can do an hour because the interview was an hour. We cut it down to about 40 minutes.
A lot of people I know liked your Anthony Weiner interview, but that was before the newest things having to do with minors. And now he may have brought down the Clinton campaign. We don't know yet.
Right.
Were you just curious, like, what makes him as an unusual guy tick, or why did you pick him for Here's the Thing?
Well, he came on because I find that we, in this shame-based media that social media in particular is so obsessed with, I thought he was somebody who people's sexual peccadilloes mean less to me than anything. I mean, what everybody's doing in the privacy of their own home, as long as they're not committing some kind of a crime, I really don't care. And he was doing these things which were, you know, he betrayed his wife and what have you. But I still thought he was this exceedingly bright guy who deserved another shot to teach or become a consultant, or there was a role for him because he was a very, very great retail politician. But then sure enough, within, it seemed like moments after I interviewed him and said, boy, you really deserve another chance in some kind of a venue, this next thing came out. And I thought, you know, obviously the issue runs a lot deeper than I imagined.
We're about out of time. Anything else you want people to know?
Well, I hope that people who are on Hillary Clinton's side, because I have an inkling now that Comey, I mean, because I think Comey should resign. I mean, Comey should resign. I mean, Comey is a disgrace to the Justice Department, and the politicization of the FBI is a terrible, terrible, terrible fear that people have, that Nixon used the FBI, but every president uses secret police, CIA, FBI to do things domestically to people who are their political enemies. That's a terrible thing to encourage, and Comey sent that signal loud and clear. Now, having said that, I think that when Clinton, if she does indeed win, because it looks that way, I hope that her side are gracious winners. I hope they don't catch the disease of the other side, which is an aggressive kind of in-your-face, spiking the ball in the end zone. I'd like to see the Clinton camp and Clinton supporters, if they win, they elevate the whole thing, the dialogue.
That's a generous thought, and I also think it's her key to success.
Right.
Because when the Trump supporters don't have her past actions as a target anymore, if she can flip the script so that what they have is her magnanimity and her new policies that are, you know, designed to include these same white working class families who feel disenfranchised, that they have that. But if she makes herself a target by being hostile, it makes it really hard.
And truly, the last thing I want to say is that when you look at this race the way it is, it only underlines one, you know, kind of simple idea for me, and that is I'm really going to miss Barack Obama, who was one of the most gracious men who ever occupied the White House in history. I mean, what a guy who – the things they said about him and tried to do to him and bait him and these ugly race-based issues. And this guy rose above, and I'm really going to miss him as president.
So before you go, is your run as Trump over now, or are you back on this Saturday night?
I know. I certainly hope not. I hope it's over. I hope it's over.
What do you mean you hope it's over? I mean if he wins, you're back on?
If he wins, I would imagine there might be some opportunity for that. But I want my weekends back so I can go be with my kids.
Alec Baldwin is the host of Here's the Thing, the WNYC podcast, among the other things that he does. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you as always.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.